fewer ERK-positive nuclei per surface area. So the authors concluded that patients with severe pulmonary hypertension, COPD, appear to have a specific histologic pattern different from the observed in patients with COPD with moderate pulmonary hypertension or without pulmonary hypertension. Questions, comments?
So I have a question. I suppose the patient COPD associated pulmonary hypertension is pre-capillary one, and why left heart function was factored in as the severity of pulmonary hypertension? And I thought it should be more right ventricular function of some, you know, sort should be regarded as a parameter.
I guess when there is basically a heart failure, then the pulmonary arterial pressure is less because of the less less pressure accumulating in the pulmonary circulation. So it's basically as far as the pressure is concerned, the weak left ventricular function is somewhat compensating for the pulmonary pressure. So I guess the heart is pumping less blood from the left ventricle, so the less blood is backed up in the pulmonary circulation.
They can, you know, define whatever way they want, but I'm just afraid they may muddle the issue by including the back pressure. You know, it doesn't go out, so it's like secondary pulmonary venous hypertension kind of a factor in this group. But anyway, I mean, I thought it kind of interesting to include that as a criteria.
I mean, I just found the methods interesting, and if you guys want to do a study on pulmonary hypertension, then maybe you can use some of these stains and methods to do that. Obviously, as I said, as far as their observation on the micro capillary density is concerned, it's really a no-brainer because fewer other septa, fewer endothelial nuclei. So that's a no-brainer. Probably you could say that at higher pulmonary hypertension, there is more muscularization of the venules and the arterioles. So I don't think the findings are earth-shaking, but again, I found the methods interesting.
So Antosh, I was wondering, I thought they had recently changed the definition of pulmonary hypertension to over 35 millimeter Hg. Now, the other groups that they call the the moderate pulmonary hypertension, which has a pressure over 25 but a low cardiac index, is that also part of the new definition?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I don't know.
Anya, are you asking about the role of cardiac index in the diagnosis of pulmonary hypertension?
Right. The clinical.
Definition. They use it as a surrogate parameter, but it's not definitive.
Okay.
All right. If no more questions, then we are moving to the next article. Clinical effectiveness of antifibrotic medications for idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis by Dempsey and colleagues. And this is also this is an interesting article, even though it's not much. It doesn't have close relationship to pathology, but they definitely use our diagnosis to make these treatments. So, since their approval, there has been no real-world or randomized trial evidence evaluating the effect of the anti-fibrotic medications pirfenidone and nintedanib on clinically important outcomes such as mortality and hospitalizations. So, again, obviously the objective of this study was to evaluate the clinical effectiveness of these agents in patients with idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. So the authors used a large U.S. insurance database and identified more than 8,000 patients with idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis between 2014 and 18. And a one-to-one propensity score matched cohort was created to compare patients on anti-fibrotic medications and no treatment. The primary outcome was all-cause mortality, and the secondary outcome was acute hospitalizations. Subgroup analyses were performed to evaluate mortality differences by drug. The use of antifibrotic medications was associated with a decreased risk of all-cause mortality. However, this was present only through the first 2 years of treatment. So we are helping the patients for 2 years. There was also a decrease in acute hospitalizations in the treated cohort. And there was no significant difference in all-cause mortality between patients receiving pirfenidone and those on nintedanib. So the authors concluded that among patients with idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, anti-fibrotic agents may be associated with a lower risk of all-cause mortality and hospitalizations compared with no treatment. And again, according to the authors, future research should test the hypothesis that these treatments reduce early but not long-term mortality as demonstrated in this study. Any questions, comments? So, go ahead.
You know, some people have criticized these drugs because everybody dies anyway, but this really looks like a cancer survival thing to me as well.
What do you mean, Tom?
We spend a lot of money on cancer drugs, and patients live a little longer, but they ultimately die of their cancer.
That's an excellent point. And, of course, pulmonary fibrosis patients can have a lung transplant, so they actually have a little better chances. Of course, these are all presumed idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis patients, so diagnosed probably mostly by CT, high-resolution CT, and in fewer cases by pathology. And, of course, they do not examine other causes of the UIP, including chronic HP and connective tissue disease. Okay. So we are moving to the next article. I'm sure this is going to be your favorite, by Kadota and colleagues. limited resection is associated with a higher risk of local regional recurrence than lobectomy in stage 1 lung adenocarcinoma with tumor spread through air spaces. So, as we all know, a growing number of independent studies have validated spread through air spaces to be a predictor of worse prognosis in lung adenocarcinoma. So the objective of this study was twofold, to investigate the prognostic significance of stents according to types of surgery and locations of recurrence, and two, the association between stents and anti-anaplastic lymphoma kinase, shortly ALK, expression. The authors analyzed a series of 735 Japanese patients with resected lung adenocarcinoma. So it was focused on adenocarcinoma, even though we know that that stents may occur with squamous cell carcinoma also. At least there is one, at least one article. the tumors were restaged according to the 8th edition of the TNM staging system. Stents was defined as tumor cells within air spaces in the lung parenchyma beyond the edge of the main tumor. So again, we know that there are many definitions exist for stents, but this study defined it as tumor cells just beyond the parenchyma, beyond the edge of the tumor. The tumors were also classified by the 2015 WHO as far as histology is concerned. Calculated the recurrence-free probability and overall survivor using the log-rank test and the Cox proportional model. So out of the 735 patients, stents was observed in 247, so it's about one third or even more than a third of the patients. Stents was more frequently identified in positive tumors. Stents was an independent prognostic factor of a worse recurrence probability in all patients. Stents was also an independent prognostic factor of a worse overall survivor in all patients and also in stage 1 patients. And in stage 1 patients with stents compared with lobectomy, limited resection was associated with a significantly higher risk of recurrence. So the authors concluded that lung adenocarcinoma with stents limited resection was associated with a significantly higher risk of recurrence than lobectomy. So I guess this justifies what our thoracic surgeons are asking now, which is to evaluate stents and frozen sections. Questions, comments?
Anprash, are you evaluating stents on frozen sections?
Correct.
Are you, Anya?
No.
I mean, that's what...
I think that's really difficult, but I can see that they will ask for it. I mean, we sometimes get a question on the final when we present it at tumor board, but... I can see that they might ask that.
I mean, my approach is that in my mind, stents is usually associated with the micropapillary pattern. So, if I see a micropapillary pattern, then I start looking more closely for stats.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And of course, they that so you, I mean, my feeling is that that the stats and the micropapillary pattern go hand in hand, and micropapillary has a worse prognosis anyway. But as you know, there are some studies showing that stas is an independent prognostic factor, independent from the micropapillary pattern.
This is that, you know, the limited resection is only for adenocarcinoma in situ or minimally invasive, and with prevalent micropapillary, that's never usually not the indication for limited resection anyway. So I guess that's a little bit of a artificial issue, you know. So my question, when was the last time you saw really small tumor, or again, like a microinvasive tumor with a micropapillary? So it's not a common thing that you will really come across in the reality.
I agree.
You know, there's some suggestion that there's some surgeon manipulation of the specimens when they're taking it out of the patient, but some institutions may see staff more than others from the analytic factors, and I was wondering if anybody hasn't talked about that.
Do you want to elaborate?
You mean some people see it more than other people, or they're over-diagnosing or were under-diagnosing?
No, Tom, I think there's been some discussion that I wasn't a direct party to, that at certain institutions, I don't know, it's been said that somehow when a surgeon takes the lobe out through a vat, they manipulate the specimen in some way, but when they're tugging on it and whatnot, that may cause more staff, so to speak, from a mechanical aspect, but that's not really been proven. But it has. Some people have stated that perhaps why some places are seeing it more than others.
There is an article out there, because when I did Pulmonary Journal Club, either last time or the last time or the previous time, I remember there being an article on is staff real or not, and they did address the fact that this may be from surgery, but from what I recall from the article, they kind of negated that and said that staph is real, and that is this is not just from surgery. And I can't remember the name of the article, but it's one of the last journal clubs I did.
So it's a fascinating topic, but if no more questions, then again, we are moving on. The next one is by Cambusher. I'm sure Tom would know how to pronounce that name.
Cambusher.
What? Say it again.
Cambusher, and it's a woman.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
She was in Mayo in 1992.
Say it again.
She was at Mayo Clinic in 1992.
Wow. All right. Well, it's certainly an interesting article. Childhood pulmonary longer hand cell histiocytosis, a comprehensive clinical histopathological and BRAF V60E mutation study from the French national cohort. So the objective of the study was to do a couple of things. We know that childhood pulmonary longer hand cell histiocytosis, PLCH, is a rare disease. It's pulmonary histopathology according to comprehensive clinical radiological findings, and BRAF V600E mutation status has not yet been thoroughly documented. So that's what they did. They looked at the histopathology, the clinical radiological findings, and the mutation. So from the 167 childhood PRCH cases entered in the French National Histiocytosis Registry, the authors retrieved lung biopsies from a consecutive retrospective series of 17 patients, diagnosed when they were 2 weeks to 16 years old. And they report the clinical histopathological findings herein. Honestly, I'm not exactly sure why they reduced their numbers to 17 when they had 167 patients, but I guess maybe complete information was available from those. As far as the results are concerned, the histological analysis of the biopsies found the following features, which were either alone or together. So obviously the total number is going to be more than 17. They had 17 patients, but each group, when you add up the groups, obviously then it's more than 17. So lung and Hodgkin's cell nodules with cavitation were present in 9 patients, cysts in 14, fibrotic scars in 2, and peribronchial topographic distribution of the lesions was characteristic in 10 patients. And then they also detected some accessory changes, that's how they call them, like stretch emphysema, and that was present in 7 patients. So according to the authors, those characteristics closely resemble those describing adult PLCH. However, unusual findings observed were 2 large nodules and a diffuse interstitial lung Langerhans cell infiltrate. So in 2 patients, nodules and diffuse interstitial Langerhans cell infiltrate were observed. The BRAF V600E mutation was detected in 4 of the 12 samples tested. So this might be just me, but expected a higher number of the mutation in this particular population, which is not less affected by smoking or not affected by smoking. And interestingly, 3 of them were with these unusual features. So again, we had 2 large nodules, 2 patients with large nodules, 1 with diffuse interstitial Langerhans cell infiltrates, and out of the 4 with the BRAF mutation, these 3 were involved. So, conclusions. Childhood PLCH mostly shares the common histology features already described in adult PLCH, regardless of age. Because smoking is considered the major trigger of PLCH pathogenesis, the findings based on this series suggest other inducers of bronchiolar Langerhans cell recruitment, especially in very young patients. Questions, comments? I guess I'm still a little unclear whether at least those 3 patients or 4 patients with BRAF mutations are considered patients with neoplasm, or what's our status on
in the adults, PLCH, it's about the same rate. It's about, you know, I forget the number, but what Anya and I published a few years ago, that has about a similar instance of a BRAF, I mean, like, yeah, BRAF V600E positivity and the mutation on the by PCR. My question is, are these kids have any systemic LCH? You might have said, but I didn't share.
I was wondering that, too.
There's a table, actually, that shows, in some of them, it's mostly just lung, and in some of them, it's multiple organs.
Hmm.
So the BRAF mutation positive kid may be the systemic LCH one, no? Do they inhibit correlation?
There's three patients that had only lung involvement, then there's a bunch that had lung and pituitary, and then there's about six or seven that have multi-systems, and it doesn't tell from the table which of those were the ones that had the mutation. I suspect it's in the text somewhere.
Although Anya's cases, they didn't have any systemic involvement in the adults, so we don't know still what to make out of those patients, whether they are clonal or still not, or what, you know.
Which, the pediatric patients?
I mean, adult patients that Anya published.
Mm-hmm. Or do you think all of them are clonal, or?
Oh, we don't know.
At least, so in the extra pulmonary, we had about 35% that were BRAF positive, and in the pulmonary was 28%. So it is about, as Joanne said, it's about what they found in the kids here.
So how would you look at clonality in Langerhans cells? I think
there's the other study. Yusin did a study years ago where he looked at clonality with a different assay and showed that there were cases that were clonal that clearly were not progressive in adults.
Yeah. So yeah. He's pretty sure it's a Humara assay. That's X chromosomal, you know,
yeah.
And assay. And he showed it's not clonal for the most part. So it was, you know, our study was something refute that theory, but we still don't know.
Yeah, I guess the fundamental question would be, does clonal equal neoplastic? And I don't think we really know the answer to that.
So in some cases, there are hematomatous proliferations that have clonality, and those are not, of course, regarded as neoplastic necessarily. They're hematomatous, which is kind of a fundamentally different process.
It's clonality comes up in strange areas. I just got a request to evaluate clonality in a celiac SPRU patient. They think that some of these refractor celiac SPRU cases are related to clonality of the T cells. They still don't consider them lymphomas. So.
I think the problem is that we want a simple answer to a complex question.
I agree, Tom. All right, last article, 6 minutes. Kratz and co-workers, incorporation of a molecular prognostic classifier improves conventional non-small cell lung cancer staging. So this is from San Francisco. Despite adoption of molecular biomarkers in the management of non-small cell lung cancer, the recently adopted 8th edition of TNM staging system utilized only clinical pathologic characteristics and validated improvement in risk stratification of early-stage disease. has remained elusive. The authors therefore evaluated the integration of a clinically validated molecular prognostic classifier into conventional staging. A novel staging system was developed by using data from 321 patients with non-small cell lung cancer at the University of California, San Francisco. This so-called TNMB with the B denoting biology system integrates a 14-gene molecular prognostic classifier into the 8th edition of the TNM staging system. This 14 molecular prognostic classifier integrates expression levels of 11 cancer-related target genes against a background of 3 reference genes. And I couldn't figure out, maybe I didn't spend enough time with it, but I couldn't figure out why they chose these 11 genes. But actually, I listed these 11 cancer-related target genes in my summary for you to read. I'm not going to read that for you. The TNMB staging system was subsequently validated in an independent multicenter cohort of 1,373 patients, and its implementation was compared with adoption of the 7th and 8th edition staging systems utilizing metrics of reclassification. So, compared with staging, according to the 8th edition of the TNM system, the TNMB staging system enhanced the identification of high-risk patients with a net reclassification involvement improvement of 0.33. It better predicted differences in survival with a relative integrated discrimination improvement of 22%. And it improved agreement between observed and predicted survival with a decrease in the reclassification calibration statistic of from 39 to 21. So the authors concluded that incorporation of a molecular prognostic classifier significantly improved identification of high-risk patients and survival predictions compared with when conventional staging is used. The TNMB staging system may lead to improved survival of early stage disease through more effective application of adjuvant therapy. So I don't think the details are that interesting, but it's certainly interesting that they used a combined classic and molecular classification to try to identify those patients that may benefit from adjuvant chemotherapy. So we have had this in the breast, for example, for a long time, and it looks like it's coming, at least according to the authors in San Francisco, to the lung. Questions, comments?
Well, they don't really provide the bridge that they can show that their classification leads toward better treatment. They say that it's possible that it might.
That's true. That's the next article. We hope. All right. Well, if there are no further questions, then I thank you for your participation, and we finish on time.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Thank you.
All in the Dropbox, I'm back.